good to see you again. I was actually gone this last week. I was in Costa Rica with a team that went to Costa Rica all of spring break. I wanted to give you a quick update, actually, or summary of what we did in Costa Rica. I know several of you were praying for us. If you bought a pumpkin last October, you helped contribute to getting us to Costa Rica. But I just want to show you a few pictures and tell you what we were up to. We took a team of 16 down to Costa Rica. 10 of those were high schoolers. And we worked with a couple different ministries or churches in Costa Rica, just trying to serve them and serve the community around them. We did a little bit of just chores, manual labor. It's not really a mission trip if you don't push a wheelbarrow of rocks up and down a steep hill. And so we did some of that, sorted clothes to be donated to different needy situations. But although we did some of that sort of manual labor, a lot of what we did was simply talk to people and talk to people about Jesus. And we worked quite a bit with kids. Here we are in a park. This ministry we were working with, they do a it's kind of an after-school program for kids. They call it their kids club. And so we meet in a park. They round up all these kids from the surrounding neighborhoods, bring them to a park, play soccer and games with them, and then share a Bible lesson and share gospel with them. And so we did a lot of that. We went into this public elementary school. This is kind of wild that this public elementary school lets us come in and just do a VBS for them. And so we spent a couple days doing a VBS where kids from kindergarten through sixth grade would come in and we'd play games with them. We'd sing some songs in Spanish and teach them some VBS songs and motions. Chad Schneider, you would have been very proud of us. We danced and did all of our motions for these kids. But also, again, we shared the gospel consistently and these classes cycled through and gave them clear presentation of what Jesus did for them. We also did a little bit more evangelism, again, just sharing Jesus with people from place to place. This is just in a neighborhood that we went through and just talked to people door to door and distributed Bibles and just tried to pray for them and talk to them if we could. I think this morning, as we were going through this neighborhood, at least one person prayed to receive Christ there. We went onto this college campus and worked a bit with this campus group that they have, most of which are unbelievers, but we tried to talk to them and again share Jesus with them. This is in a park, just doing some evangelism also. This is us praying with, I think there were about four teenage guys that prayed to receive Christ with us right there. And so we did a lot of that, just really trying to talk to people about Jesus. And then, of course, there's the nighttime Uno games that are necessary, and the strategy here is just to stay more awake and alert than your opponents here, and then you're probably going to win. But we had a great time, so appreciate your prayers. And I think what really stood out, what was impressed on all of us as we went down there was this: 1 Corinthians 1:18, for the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. And I think we were really refreshed in the power of the gospel. Sometimes you can forget that the message of Jesus has this transformational power. It really does. It's not just simple words, a simple story, but it is powerful. And we saw that. A number of people prayed with us to receive Christ, and we saw the gospel go out to literally hundreds, and we saw the power of it. And so it was great to be refreshed in the power of the simple message of Jesus' death and resurrection. But we went to Costa Rica, but that wasn't and isn't all that is happening here internationally. At the beginning of the year, we laid out a little bit of a vision and some of the things that we want to focus on this year. One of those was simply missions. And a lot is happening. You know, not only did we go to Costa Rica, but there are other people in this church already this year that have gone to Cambodia and to France, and there are trips being planned and considered to Japan and to the Middle East, and there are long-term missionaries overseas right now, and there's just a lot going on in that arena. There are a lot of people flying over oceans this year, and it's really exciting. And we're going to talk more about that in 2 weeks. So after Easter, we're going to start our missions campaign, and we're going to talk about what is happening internationally here, because I think there's some There are some exciting things that are going on. All right, well, let's dive into our message this morning now. We're in Galatians chapter 6. We're going to cover verses 1 through 10. You can open up your Bibles to Galatians 6. It's on page 975 in your house Bible. And we are wrapping up the book of Galatians. We've just got two more weeks, this week and next week, to finish the book of Galatians. I think it's been a fantastic journey. I think it's refreshed us in a lot of really important gospel truth and our identity in Jesus. But we're almost to the end. Now, oftentimes when Paul finishes a letter, he will leave his readers with a lot of just rapid-fire practical instruction. Okay, so it reads almost like the book of Proverbs often, where he'll say this, do this, and don't do this, and remember this, and it's like he's just dumping a lot of his final thoughts very quickly. He's covered all of the really meaty theology in the early chapters, and he's given the church some specific thoughts for them, and now he's just going to leave them with a handful of practical encouragement. And that's similar here in Galatians. And you read these verses that we're going to read, and it does read almost like Proverbs, where he's leaving them with a bunch of different ideas to consider. However, although it can read that way at first glance, I think it is important to understand, and hopefully we'll see this, is that these aren't just a bunch of disconnected proverbs. They are connected together and intertwined a lot more than we first realize. And I think we're going to see that as we go along. But let's read the passage, and then we're going to come back and discuss it verse by verse. Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Keep watch on yourself, lest you too be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But let each one test his own work, and then his reason to boast will be in himself alone and not in his neighbor. For each will have to bear his own load. Let the one who has taught the word share all good things with the one who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever one sows, that will he also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption, but the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. And let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up. So then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those who are of the household of faith. All right, let's go back and work through this. And we'll start with the first part of verse 1. Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Yes, there's this charge to restore that person who may be caught in sin. There's a very similar passage at the end of the book of James that I wanted to read. James 5, 19 and 20. My brothers, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins. So at the end of each of these letters, there is a strong charge given to us, to the Christian, to when we see somebody that is drifting, that is potentially trending towards sin or turning their back on the faith, to chase them down, okay, to pursue them, to be stirred and provoked to proactively chase that person down. Now, this can be very, very practical, maybe very relevant for many of us. If you've been a Christian for very long at all, you have probably watched someone drift. Probably watched somebody step into sin or watched somebody deny the faith. And so maybe that situation is coming to mind right now, and it's very relevant. And we want to let it be relevant and let what Paul is saying here settle on us and perhaps convict and motivate us to take action if we need to take action. So I think this is a really, really important charge that he gives us here. and I want to try to draw that out. So let's do that first. So let me point out a few things about this verse. Number one, he is addressing those who are spiritual. Okay, you who are spiritual. Now remember what he just covered in chapter 5. He was just talking about life in the Spirit, the fruits of the Spirit. He was really defining what a spiritual person looks like. And it might not be what we first think. We might think, okay, a spiritual person is, we have this mystical picture in our mind, like a spiritual person levitates or something like that. But the way that he defines it in chapter 5 is, know that the fruits of the Spirit flow out of this person. Okay, so love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control, those things are expressed through the spiritual person. And so he gives that overview in chapter 5. I think in chapter 6 now, he is zeroing in on specific applications or specific expressions of spirituality. Okay, this is what a spirit-filled spiritual person does specifically. But if I was to list out specific activities or expressions of a spiritual person, this probably wouldn't have been top on my list. Might not have been on my list, but it is here. And this is what Paul points out. If that's true, if he's giving some specific examples now in Galatians 6 of what a spiritual person does, this is what he highlights. A spiritual person chases down the sinner. And that kind of makes sense. Okay, if you're living in the Spirit, you have this Spirit of Christ that is flowing through you, you mimic him. And Jesus came to seek and save the lost, and he chases people down. He leaves the 99 to find the one. That's his Spirit. And so a spiritual person does the same. Okay? So let's state that right now, and then I'm going to set it aside, and I want to move to the next verse, verse 2. Verse 2 is a familiar verse to a lot of us. Again, it can feel like one of those proverbs. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Interesting language that he uses here. Of course, he's been talking the whole letter about the law. And he's been encouraging the Galatians to understand that they are free from the law, from the old covenant. They're no longer obligated to live under the old covenant. They're free. And so he's speaking to release them from that. But here he uses this law language again. But now he's saying the law of Christ. Okay, you've been freed from the old covenant law, but you are still walking in submission to the law of Christ. But what is that? Well, I think, again, it is mimicking Christ, and obedience to the law of Christ is characterized by self-sacrificing burden carrying. Okay, so that's what we do if we're living in submission to Jesus. We're mimicking him, and we're doing what he did, and we're carrying each other's burdens. Okay, we're bearing those burdens. And the burdens mentioned here probably involve all kinds of afflictions. I think there's broad application here. Okay, whether that's health or financial or emotional burdens, when we see somebody struggling in one of those areas, this is a charge to bear those burdens, to get in there, to help lift that weight off of somebody's shoulders. And so we should, and I think we do, and I'm encouraged by our church as I see that kind of burden carrying happening. And when somebody is battling with some health issue or financial issue, I think oftentimes, it's definitely not perfectly, but we rally and we help to carry those burdens. So we want to continue to do that. But I also might say this, but perhaps the burden of sin is most in view here. I'm not convinced verse 2 is that disconnected from verse 1. In fact, I think verses 1 through 5 are a unit. That's why the ESV divides the chapters as it does. Yeah, I think it's still talking about what he talked about in verse 1. And he's saying to bear one another's burdens, all of them, But especially be aware of when somebody is drifting into sin, get in there with them. Help them. Carry that in some way. Again, mimic your Savior here and be willing to bear that burden. After all, sin is the heaviest burden we can carry. And sometimes we forget that, and we think that the health issues and the financial issues and the emotional issues and that those are the heavy ones, and they are heavy. We can't minimize that, and yet they're not nearly as heavy as sin. And when we're caught in a sin, it crushes us, it destroys us. And I think he's charging us to get in there proactively. Don't rest, don't step back, but get in there and help this person that you see to be drifting. Now, this isn't easy. Again, you might think of that specific situation that comes to mind for you, and you know how challenging it is. And it's hard for so many of us to confront people and to wade into what could potentially be conflict there. You know, you've heard maybe the old metaphor or analogy of some people who are turtles and some who are skunks. You know, when it comes to conflict or some relational struggle, some of us are turtles. We see the relational difficulty, and so we retreat into our shell, and we hide and hope it passes over us quickly. And then others, they're skunks. They see the difficulty coming, and they see the threat, and so they spray. Okay, they get big and stinky. And we all have these tendencies. Quick show of hands, how many of you are turtles? Okay, good number of turtles out there. You especially can talk yourself out of doing what's commanded here. And I think back over my life, and I think there are a lot of regrets that I have when I sensed somebody was dabbling in sin. I sensed somebody was beginning to drift, and I was passive. And I talked myself out of it, and I made excuses, and I said, maybe I don't see this situation correctly. I don't want to judge. I want to give them freedom to explore and figure things out. And maybe I'm not that close to them, and there's probably somebody else in better position to confront this issue. And too often, I think I felt myself step back or not respond quickly enough. But I think we need to, again, let this charge settle on us, recognizing how vital this battle is that is happening with this person, how important it is. Remember, faith in Jesus is the most precious gift we can have. Okay? It's everything. And if somebody is loosening their grip on that precious gift, it should stir something. We should feel compelled to get in there. And I just want this morning to be a bit of an encouragement. Whatever situations are out there, when you see somebody drifting, to respond and to care enough about them to get in there. And if somebody does approach us, that we would really cherish that. Even if they don't see things correctly, maybe they're not quite seeing things, but if somebody approached me and tried to point out something in my life, I would hope I would respond with this deep gratitude. Thank you so much that you're willing to point that out in my life. I hope that if ever I am dabbling in sin, there will be those that track me down, that pursue me. So this is a strong call, and I think we want to take this seriously to pursue the one who is caught in sin. But raise your hand if you're a skunk. Okay, turtles are a little more sheepish, but the skunks are like, yeah, that's That's me. I'm kind of proud of it. I think the rest of the paragraph here is actually for you. Because we're given this charge that we must obey to chase down the one who is straying. But a lot of the rest of the paragraph here is a warning about doing it correctly. Okay, we've got to do it well. Okay? And so I just want to walk through this and give us 5 points that he mentions here in this passage about how to restore a sinner. Okay? So when restoring a sinner, you must do so, number one, with a spirit of gentleness. So he says that very plainly in verse one. Okay, to restore it, but do it with a spirit of gentleness. And so clearly we are doing this in an effort to persuade, not just coming in with guns blazing, not just with a hammer, but there is a gentle spirit that we must approach this with. Okay, so that must characterize how we speak to people when we are confronting them about something like this, about sin. So do it with a spirit of gentleness. Secondly, with an awareness of your own susceptibility to temptation. That's what it says, watch out so that you don't sin also. And I think there is a susceptibility, probably on a couple different levels. Number one, I think when you start wading in and start seeing sin, perhaps the human heart is drawn to pursue sin in the same way. I think that can definitely happen. But I wonder if the sin that he's especially talking about here is really the sin of pride. Okay, that it's very, very easy to arrogantly try to restore somebody. And that leads us to the next point, because that's what I think he expands on in the next few verses. So number three, without thinking more highly of yourself than is warranted. So he says, for if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. And so it's probably pretty easy when you see sin in somebody to elevate yourself and to think pretty highly of yourself and to separate yourself from that person. I'm just in a different category. There's the sinner down there and I'm the righteous one up here. And I think he's just warning, do not think of yourself very highly. Instead, with a lot of just fear and trembling and contriteness, realize that you are just as susceptible to this sin. And so go in there with a lot of humility. Number four, without comparing yourself to another, but evaluating yourself on the merit of your own work. You know, this is interesting. It almost feels like verse four is contradicting verse three. Verse three tells you not to think too highly of yourself, and then verse four talks about having reason to boast in yourself. And what's going on here? Well, I think what he's saying is that when you go into this kind of restoration process, that you're not thinking real highly of yourself because you're not comparing yourself to others, to the sinner or to how other people handle this. Instead, you're just entering it because you're entering the situation because it's what you're supposed to do. This is what God is bringing you to. And so you're carrying out this service that God has entrusted to you. And so you're not comparing yourself in such a way that exalts you over others. Instead, you're just bringing your own initiative here. And then you can take a sense of pride in just stepping in there based on what you are already called to do. Number five, while realizing that you are accountable before God alone. Verse 4 seemed like it was contradicting verse 3. Verse 5 kind of seems like it's contradicting verse 2. Because verse 2 says to bear each other's burdens, and then verse 5 says each will have to bear his own load. But I think he's speaking about bearing these loads or burdens in a different way. And here I think he's just saying, realize when you enter this situation, you're accountable for God. You're going to stand before God, and you're going to have to bear your own responsibility of how you handled this situation. So you're going to bear your own load in that sense. You're going to stand before God. You're going to be accountable before him as to how you handled this situation. So in summary, we are called to proactively pursue those who are drifting. And I think we must take that very, very seriously. And hopefully this morning, again, can bring about an appropriate amount of conviction and motivation that if there is a situation that you're witnessing right now, that you would take those steps. So we are to proactively get in there, and yet to do it with a great humility. It should just be characterized by an incredible humility and gentleness as we do it. Okay, let's move on to the next paragraph. We're going to start with verse 6. It says this, "Let the one who is taught the word share all good things with the one who teaches." And we're kind of talking financially here. So my task this morning is to teach you to give to your teachers. And that can feel a little awkward, right? And that can feel a little awkward, especially because I know the guardedness that can arise when this topic is encountered here, and justifiably so. You know, we have all seen abuses in this area, sometimes up close, sometimes from a distance. But for 2,000 years, ministers have abused this principle. And that's why Paul in 1 Timothy 6 warns against those people who would use godliness as a means for financial gain. It happens, and it happens, of course, we can look around our world and see it all over. One of my favorite examples, maybe favorite's not the word to use, but one example that that stands out to me, maybe you guys have seen this Instagram account called Preachers and Sneakers. And if you're not familiar with it, you should go look it up if you want to be really discouraged, actually. And what happened about 5 years ago, this guy started noticing pastors and worship leaders wearing really nice shoes. And some of these really prominent, well-known preachers, he'd get pictures or videos of them, see them online, and just notice they're wearing these really nice shoes. And so he started this Instagram account and turned into a book and other resources, and he shows a pastor or a worship leader with his shoes, and next to it he shows a page where you can buy these shoes, and most of these pairs of sneakers are like $800 or $1,200. Occasionally they'll get a $3,000 pair of shoes. And I was going through this yesterday. I remembered hearing about it a few years ago, and so I stepped back into it yesterday and was going through it. And again, it's kind of humorous at first, and then it's like, this is really disgusting. And I got on these rabbit trails, and I'd see these guys and look at other pictures of them, and it's not like a lot of these guys just have one pair. It would be tacky if you just wore one pair of shoes all the time. And so it's like these multiple pairs of $800 pairs of shoes. And so you see that, and it's public, and it's well known. And so rightly, you can develop this sort of guardedness, defensiveness when this topic comes up because you recognize the abuses. But let me in response say, for one, maybe I hang out in the wrong circles. But I don't think I know any pastors who wear $800 pairs of shoes. I don't know if I know of any pastors who wear $80 pairs of shoes. I think those public cases in many ways are the outliers. Okay. And for every pastor on Preachers and Sneakers, there's 100 or maybe 1,000 that are in a very, very different situation. So I think we can speak to the typical situation here. And besides, this is in the Bible. And so one of I think the good things about just teaching exegetically is you go through the Bible, chapter by chapter, verse by verse, is you let the Bible set the table. And just kind of tee up the topics for you. And so it's fully appropriate to discuss this verse and this passage. Especially because it's discussed so often in the New Testament. And so I do feel like I should teach this, and I can do it unashamedly and confidently and even strongly. And so
So let me try to do that. First of all, let me, after reading this verse, also put up the rest of the paragraph there. Now, again, I don't think this really struck me before digging into this passage, really just this past week. Again, I thought this was these verses were maybe a little more proverbial, a little more disconnected. But after reading several commentaries, a lot of commentaries feel like this also is a unit. Like verses 6 through 10 are talking about kind of the same thing or have the same thing in view. And so verses 7 through 10 are perhaps expanding on verse 6. And I think there's validity to that. Now, verses 7 through 10 have broader application again, which I'm going to get to a little later, but I think they are in support of verse 6, which again makes me feel compelled to teach it. But when it says things like, you know, God cannot be mocked, or the one who sows will reap, and let us not grow weary of doing good, and doing good especially to the household of believers, it may have verse 6 in view, at least to an extent. Okay? So, how should we handle this? Well, what I'm going to do today is I'm just going to reference a few of the other passages that talk about this subject as well. Okay? And really charge you to read them and to wrestle with them and see what you think and see how God would lead you in these different ways. And so I want to reference three other passages that discuss this same topic. And again, I'm not going to read them all because a couple of them are extended passages, which is kind of noteworthy, I think, that so much ink is given to this topic. But you can go home and read them. I'm just going to pull a verse or two out of each of these passages, make a quick point, and then we'll move on. So, the subject of supplying financial need, especially to ministry. Okay, there's a few passages that I'll just reference here this morning. So 1 Corinthians 9, 1 through 18, again, a long passage, but Paul is talking about this subject, and he's kind of wrestling through with the Corinthians how they should approach giving to him and to different ministers. And he does it very tactfully, but at the same time, he does it boldly and strongly. And I'll just reference this one verse, verse 11, if we have sown spiritual things among you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? And I think that's much of the point that he's trying to make. And for us, I think what we can take here, this point to make, is that if you receive spiritual nourishment from a church, and not just from the teaching pulpit ministry, that would certainly be a component of it, but the fellowship of the church, the community, the examples that you see, the works that you're led into, the whole package, that if you receive that kind of nourishment from a spiritual body, it would probably be strange to not support that spiritual body financially. Okay. And that just seems to be the point that I think he's making in this passage, that just would seem fairly natural. Again, if you're receiving spiritual nourishment. Now, if anybody here is new, I would say don't worry about this immediately. You know, I think if somebody is invested into a church, they're in the body, they are receiving that spiritual nourishment, and they have been for a time, then I think there's a partnership that develops. So until that happens, I don't think there needs to be a deep concern here for you. But the point is that, again, being a part of this body probably should provoke a spirit of giving. Okay, next, 1 Timothy 5, 17 and 18. Let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in preaching and teaching. For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain, and the laborer deserves his wages. And this verse that he references, you shall not muzzle an ox, it's from the book of Deuteronomy. It's also mentioned actually in the 1 Corinthians 9 passage. But really the point here is just that I think a church ministry is to not feel overly constrained you know, that muzzling feeling. And so there's just an encouragement to work to open up the ministry unconstrainedly of the church. Next, Philippians 4, 10 through 20, again, an extended passage. I won't read it all, but I'll read a few verses. It says, "Yet it was kind of you to share my trouble. Not that I seek the gift, but I seek the fruit that increases to your credit. I have received full payment and more. I am well supplied, having received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent, a fragrant offering, a sacrifice acceptable and pleasing to God." And I think the point just to make from this little section here is one, that there is an investment made. He says, I seek the fruit that increases to your credit. And I think in investing into kingdom spiritual work, it produces a fruit. That's why so often in these passages, just like in James, he uses the language of sowing and reaping. There's an investment, there's a planting of seeds, and there's a fruitfulness that comes out of that. But also, God's pleased by it. It's a fragrant offering. Pleases and honors the Lord, I think, when we join him in this partnership. Now with that, I wanted to give you just a quick summary, just very practically here. This would probably be the time to do it. I think here we feel well taken care of in this church. And we've talked about that in recent months. So we've talked about finances and we've laid out some numbers. And I think we have been very encouraged. A little over a year ago, it felt very tight. Things were pretty lean. And yet, in the last year or more, there's really been a growth, and we feel very encouraged. And so, as most of you know, we paid off our building just last month. And so, so yeah, that's something to celebrate. And just to get it on your calendar, if you haven't heard, in a little over a month, we are going to celebrate that a little more officially. So Saturday night, April 27th, we're going to have a building payoff celebration. And so it's just going to be here in the lobby. We're not going to do dinner, but we are going to have some kind of gourmet-ish snacks and desserts. I think it's going to be good. And we're just going to hang out and probably play some games, have some fun, reflect a little bit. But I think it's going to be a great time. So Saturday, April 27th, you can certainly join us to celebrate 20 years of consistent investment into this tool that God has given us, and now we are debt free. So we're really excited about that, and that does put us on a different trajectory, and so we are encouraged by that. And we to start off with, after removing our mortgage payments, that frees up a lot for us. a lot of that is actually going to go to salary. So since we're talking about really supplying financial need in terms of compensation in this passage, which is one to make you aware, a lot of that freedom that we have by paying off the building will go to helping bring up salaries to what we think are appropriate levels. Like I said, I think things were kind of lean. We have been running very leanly for a while, but now we want to bring our entire staff up to what we think are appropriate compensation levels. And we have what we call our financial review committee. We have three people that help us within the congregation here take a look at our finances and give us counsel and everything. I didn't tell them I was going to mention them here, but I'll do it anyways, just in case you want to talk to them. So Mark Saunders and Steve Svoboda and Vanessa Fitzgerald help keep an eye on our finances and give us counsel, like I said, and help us each budgeting cycle to make decisions there. And they helped us come up with some more well-refined targets for salaries for all the positions here at SumUpU. And so we have, I believe, a total of 13 employees here, eight full-time, five are part-time, various hours there. And they've helped us come up with targets for those salaries. We think we were low. Like I said, things were pretty lean. So we're inching our way up there. And so we're actually in a three-year process of bringing those salaries up to what we think is appropriate. And we're on track to do that. And so we do feel blessed in that way. Now, the one thing to add to that, though, is that the plan that we've laid out over 3 years to bring compensation up to appropriate levels and to expand ministry in different ways, that still depends also on on a growth in regular tithe income. And so this plan we have is assuming at least 2% growth in tithe income every year. And right now we're right at about that, about 2% tithe income for this fiscal year. So in summary, what I'm saying is I think we feel well supported, and yet we're not out of the woods, and we got to just, you know, continue to put our shoulder to that. But in general, we feel pretty blessed, and we appreciate your generosity and how you've supported this church, especially this past year. Okay, let me move on. there are multiple sermons this morning, so let me give my last one. Okay, so like I said, verses 6 through 10 might be a package. I think that's probably true, and I think a lot of commentators think that. And yet, there's still broader application. And I wanted to read verses 9 through 10. These are some of my favorite verses, actually. And I think they're important for us. Let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up. So then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those who are of the household of faith. And I wanted to read these here at the end, just because I don't want any of us to be weary of doing good. And I would hope that we can continue to do good without growing weary and faint-hearted. All good that we can do is hard. We're in a battle out there. And so whenever we do good, it usually there's opposition. Usually it's slow progress. Occasionally there'll be little blips where something pretty wild happens, but usually it's slow progress and it takes just a perseverance. But it's easy to grow weary in that. We're all doing different kinds of good, and sometimes it just feels like it's such a slog and it doesn't feel like anything's happening and no difference is being made. This is one of my favorite parenting verses, actually. Because sometimes when parenting, especially of young kids, feels like I'm doing the same thing over and over and over, and this kid isn't getting it. And there's no progress being made. And it's so easy to become weary of doing good. And that can be applied to all kinds of different situations. Maybe something comes to mind for you where you just feel weary and you're not sure if you want to continue. And I just want to urge us to continue, to not grow weary of doing good, and that God promises here a reaping if we do not give up. That if he has directed us into something, that we can confidently pursue that and keep tracking with that good. But how do we do that? What's the fuel? What helps us to continue through weariness? Let me just go to Hebrews 12:3 really quickly. It says, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. So how do we avoid growing weary? Very simply, consider him. Okay, dwell on Jesus. Meditate on who he is, and specifically his endurance of hostility from sinners. Okay, to think about that. Now that, of course, is very appropriate for this week, as we move into Holy Week. Let me read Matthew 27:27-31. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand, and kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they spit on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him. And you just try, I think this week especially, we consider him. We consider this endurance. And we think about this and we try to imagine what this would be like. That he endured this kind of mockery and belittlement from sinful people when he had the power to just stop it. Okay, Jesus just could have crushed all of this. You know, at the same time, his friends were abandoning him and denying him. He was very alone here. And it would have been so tempting, Jesus in his humanity, to say, I'm done with these people. But he endured. He endured this level of mockery and motivates us to do the same. Band, you can go ahead and come on back up. We're going to sing one last song. But as you think about the good that you are tempted to grow weary of, I think what God prompts us to do is to think about this. You know, just to consider him. Think about how Jesus did this. And Jesus, despite all of this mockery and belittlement and abandonment and denial, he continued on. And he continued to the cross and he died. And he died because we owed that consequence. Okay, we were supposed to be killed because of our sin, but he took that sin on himself. But it's not just that he died, he endured all of this hostility from sinful people. And my hope is that we can simply consider that over and over and over again this week and beyond. But especially this week, to consider that hostility and that Jesus endured it, and he gives us the power to endure when encountering that hostility or just that weariness as well.